begin. Proverbs 17:6. Let's go there. Man, just in light of where we're headed this morning with David and the coming revolt, the coup, to preview a little bit of where we're headed. This is a great proverb, and something I learned in men's fraternity, if you guys have been through that. We'll talk through it here in a second. Proverbs 17:6. If you're there, give it a read for us. All right, grandchildren are the crown of old men. Like, you've been around grandfathers. I was sitting with Eric Hansen the other night at a dinner, and man, he could not stop talking about his grandson. I mean, loves his grandson. He's like, it's so much better than raising kids, right? He's like, kids are terrible. Grandkids like you. Like, they love, you know, so he's just, that's his thing in life, man. He's a different dude since he's had grandkids. If you guys know the Hansons, he's a fun guy, but just loves Jed, right? His grandson. And the other maybe way to view that, from grandchildren are the crown of old men, the glory of sons is their fathers. And that's kind of the part that I want to look at. What does it mean that the glory of sons is their fathers? A right relationship with dad, when this is done correctly, how is a son to view his father? That word, by the way, glory, is translated other places as like a turban or a crown or pride, if you will. How are we as sons supposed to view our fathers? Respect. Yeah, not just respect, but it's like, man, that's my dad. Like, I honor him because I've got a great relationship with him. And like, it's that's what I aspire to be as an example, right? And so many of us, that feels even foreign to say, right? To have a dad like that. I went through a study called Men's Fraternity years ago. A pastor at a Little Rock Bible Church in Little Rock, Arkansas, wrote it. And he talks about it's a big men's study, and he talks about kind of the five, he calls them five wounds that deeply affect men. And one of them is called the absent father wound. And it's the idea that whether your dad was physically absent, emotionally absent, spiritually absent, whatever it may be, that these wounds drill deep into a kid's psyche. And we're going to meet a guy, one of David's sons this morning, that is the quintessential absent father wound. And when you see what it creates in a kid down the road, usually a kid will kind of deviate into one of two areas. One will be the perfectionist kid that's going to be straight A's, perfect. Everything and anything he can do to earn his father's approval, right? Or they'll take the other fork in the road, which is, well, you don't like me anyway, so screw you. I will go live a crazy nuts life, and I will get attention one way or the other. And if I can't get positive attention, I'll get negative attention. Drugs, alcohol, whatever it may be, right? And kids, at the root of that often, is just this very simple need for a love from their father. And that's not to say that gals don't have the exact same issue, but for sons, it was just one of those things that stuck out. And it was fascinating to me. I bring that up. Robert Lewis makes the observation, and I can't find anywhere in Scripture to support it, but I think it's brilliant, and he's a biblical dude, so maybe one of you guys that are smarter than me can find it. He makes the observation that that word glory, the root word of glory, is actually the word weight, or used that way at some point. It's the idea that dads add weight to their kids' lives, to their sons' lives, like a ballast in a ship, so when the sails get pushed, in terms of what's above the waterline, what's below the waterline is this big, like, anchor that can create stability in the water, so that when the winds are so strong that they could topple the ship over, there's this counterbalance underneath the waterline, if you will. And he's got the idea of that weight, okay? So if you've heard John Mayer songs about, you know, daughters and that sort of thing, I mean, there's just a lot, obviously, on that subject. Think about that in terms of the weight that you're going to put one day as moms, as dads, in our lives specifically as dudes, with our sons or with our daughters. We are going to add ballast. We are going to add weight, ultimately, to our kids' lives. So think through that. Many of you guys, me included, have absent father wounds, right, that we are reeling from in some ways, whether we know it or not, those wounds in our life. I told you guys the other day I was watching a show called The Selection on the History Channel. Have any of you guys seen that, by the way? If you're military fans at all or enjoy that genre of history, it's a fascinating show. They basically take 30 people off the street, super fit, CrossFitters, every walk of life, and they take them through military special ops training, right? So they go through what the Navy SEALs would go through, and they just see, like, man, how many of these people could actually finish with a non-military background what these guys have to do every day? And one of the guys on the show is a professional obstacle course racer. He's like the Spartan races and Tough Mudders. Like, he's paid professionally to do that. He is a specimen. Literally, the guys that are Navy SEALs are like, it's legit, right? And they walk through the interview process of all these guys, and you're trying to figure out why this guy's there, and he's kind of crushing everybody. He's arrogant, right? He knows he's better than everybody else, and he's not afraid to tell everybody he's better than everybody else. But through this whole endeavor, he ends up finishing the deal. So sorry to ruin the end for you. But they do interviews throughout this process. So yes, it's only one season. There's like 8 episodes. Anyway, so and they do interviews each time. At the end of it, in this one little moment, he talks about his relationship with his dad, and he says, "My dad has never told me that he's proud of me." You guys, oh buddy, your whole life is spent doing all these things just to earn your father's approval, because your dad is too stubborn and too hard-nosed to tell you that he loves you and that he's proud of you. And literally, you watch this kid's life, everything he's done is to earn his dad's approval. I was the all-star quarterback, that didn't work, so I did this, and I started racing as an amateur, and you know, my dad was like, okay, and then professional, like, he thinks one day he's going to amount enough glory that his dad's going to go, now I'm proud of you. And it's just this sick, awful cycle. So anyway, it's one of the greatest things we can offer as parents is wait to our kids, let them know that we're proud of them despite their achievements. You can be proud of their achievements, certainly, but if their life is dependent upon what they do to make mom and dad happy, boy, that is it's a kid's going to end up wrecked. So some of you are going to have the privilege of starting over, right, and stopping whatever cycle that you've been a part of, which is tough. But if you're in that realm, just remember that. Okay, you guys often have the choice to say, you know what, we're not going to continue whatever the U-Haul worth of baggage is in my family. We're going to stop, and we're going to start over, and we're not going to continue those cycles. So anyway, so think through that, right? Proverbs 17:6. Any thoughts on that? Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Did that take a while? Did you notice what you were doing? Or?
I think, thankfully, I was exposed to some of that material before my kids were too old. So, like, the recognition of, like, wow, I have some. And I say, man, on a scale of 1 to 10, mine aren't that heavy. I had an abusive alcoholic father, my biological father, who left the scene when I was 2.5. My mom remarried. My stepfather, who's my adopted dad, is great. So he's a different type of dad. He's not super vocal. But I felt ballast in my life from him, if you will. So he supported me, he loved me. He wasn't always really verbal, but I never questioned whether or not I had his approval and love. Does that make sense? So my wounds weren't, not to make it a comparison, but I know lots of people whose wounds were far deeper and took far more to get through than mine did. So, but part of it was just acknowledging the fact that, yeah, I do, and I got to choose to do things different. So, and it's hard because I don't feel like at times I always have a playbook. Like, man, I didn't come to Christ until I was 19. I'm trying to raise girls in my house that are walking with God in junior high. I'm like, I have no concept of that whatsoever. Like, I didn't even think about God or trying to make decisions based on that lens. Like, that's completely foreign to me. So, I don't know. We're going to screw some of them up. We're putting money away for counseling. It's just, you know, we realize that we're not going to do it perfect and, you know, great. So we tell them all the time, you can work it out in counseling. So we'll put another $20 in there. Y'all go figure it out later. Yeah, Troy.
I just had an opportunity to present on fatherhood and fatherlessness and tie-in at a conference this past weekend. And when I was doing my research for it, the National Fatherhood Initiative had stated that they have done, I guess there's tons of primary research that shows that even if you have like a father substitute, like daddy deprivation, daddy substitution, and seeing, even having like a stepfather in the picture who's loving, care, even never having your biological father, whether you even met him or not, has a, like, just a deep seated effect on the individual. It was just fascinating.
Yeah.
Even if they've never met him.
Absolutely.
They have a loving stepfather.
There's a psychological. Yeah. Absolutely.
It was just fascinating. I was like, man, I didn't know how
And depending on what side of the pendulum you swing, or as you look at kind of the debates of what's just happening in our society, there are some folks that would look at the scope of specifically incarcerated African-American men and would say one of the major problems, if not the major problem, is a lack of fathers in their lives. And statistically, it's very provable.
So Dr. Eric Mason, they had initially started something for fathers because they thought that it was an epidemic that was isolated to concentrated poverty, but actually transcends. It's like it's an epidemic nationally, and in suburban homes as well. Like all these kids with emotional problems that you're dealing with that are popping pills, suicides at Clovis. Well, I mean, all this stuff. They're saying that 1 in 3 children, 23 million children, are fatherless right now.
Yeah.
And they're saying that almost every single societal ill that we face today is linked somehow.
Yeah. And I read that from an African-American male pastor. And man, that's a fascinating observation from someone that doesn't live in that culture. But yeah, it transcends just, for what it's worth. So noodle on that. Gang, think about that. At the end of the day, you can be a lot of things. Some of you are super talented. You can go make a ton of money. You can be successful in a lot of different adventures in life. There are a few roles that no one else can play in your life. And one of them is a parent to your child. Whether you are the mother of a child or the dad of a child, nobody else can do that but you. Anybody can come teach residency. Anybody can come take my job at Off the Front. Like, they're unique and they're fun, but I'm replaceable. But there's a couple roles in my life. I'm the husband to my wife. Nobody else can be that. I'm the father to 3 kids. Nobody else can be that. So as you think through how you weight and prioritize your life, you got to think through those things. Those need to be important. And unfortunately, ladies, especially you, my wife, who's a stay-at-home mom with a master's degree, she's looked upon as like, oh, that's so cute. You little valedictorian that couldn't get a real job. You stay at home with your kids. Like, that is not esteemed in society. So you guys, if those are values for you, if you choose to stay at home, those are your choices, society is not going to uplift that in a feministic culture to say that that is worthy of your time and investment. So. But I tell you, you take any second grade teacher, and without knowing, they can tell you exactly which parents were at home for the first 8 years of that kid's life and exactly which kids weren't. And it is clear as the day is long, who had a mother or father that spent consistent time with them. My mother-in-law was a second grade teacher for years. She's like, it is plain as day, right? So yeah, those parents drive nicer cars and live in a bigger house. But their kids usually have some type of void in their life as a result of 2 dinks, dual income. What is the dual income?
No kids.
Yeah. So that started that way and then worked into life and went, oh gosh, now we're stuck in this lifestyle that we can't get out of and have 2 car payments and a house payment and we have to have 2 40-hour-week jobs to sustain it. So you'll be swimming upstream a lot. So. Noodle on it. But man, to see the ramifications, as Troy mentioned, those are great statistics. Shay's got some other ones as well that are haunting. So noodle on that. And you're going to watch a guy today that his whole life flounders because of David and his inability to father, to parent correctly. It's awful. So.
What's her master's degree?
She has is it biblical studies with an emphasis in counseling? She got it online. It took her about 10 years to do it. This is funny. She started her degree right after I finished at DTS. So that was in 2001 at Andersonville Baptist Seminary in Atlanta, Georgia. And they would send her tapes. And she got so delayed, we had like a box full of tapes that she would have to listen to that we no longer had a tape player. And they since closed down the seminary, renamed it something else, and we're like, are you guys still honoring this program? But we had to go buy like a cassette tape player to finish her degree, so it was so funny. But yeah, so she finished, she persevered through it, and you know, so yeah, it's a funny story, but yeah, so I don't know where those tapes are now, but she got through them all, so anyway, so yep, that's my bride. All right, gang, 2 Sam, shall we? Lots going on in this text to come. Let me pray for us. God, we're grateful in a day and age when so often our father figures are absent and not at all what we would hope they would be is even grown kids, Father, that you are a good God, that you are a father to us, a father to the fatherless. Lord, I pray, Father, that we would be cognizant of the role that we get to play in that area, that we would be a generation that continues to value and esteem both men and women that pour into their kids, that would not be some secondary minor role that we play in life, but God, that we would value that. And God, I pray that we would model our parenting after you, a gracious, loving father that cares for his kids. We're so grateful that you use that terminology and that word picture for us to see, that we can know what a right view of a dad is, God. So as we look through the eyes of David this morning, see his imperfections and his flaws, and we get good and downwind of ourselves, God, in that process, Lord, would you use this time to mold us and shape us, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right, so we are on the back hillside of Camelot. It is not so awesome anymore in the kingdom, right? We're through David and Bathsheba that we talked through in great detail on Friday. So thanks for the your insights and good chat on that. In chapter 12, we see David obviously get confronted by Nathan the prophet on this sin. He confesses it. There are going to be consequences. And we find out, ultimately, the kid that David and Bathsheba have together is going to die. We're going to see some ramifications of that sin. We're going to see some great theology in the midst of this. So very practical for you and I as we encounter other folks that have lost young kids. Some stuff in here that you may turn to later on in life. Okay, so with that, 2 Samuel chapter 12. Let's get into now the backside of this is terms of what's happening with David. So chapter 12, verse 17, the elders of his house stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground. David was unwilling. He could not eat food with them. So David is in mourning. He has heard that his child's going to die. He is an absolute emotional wreck. Okay, so for 7 days, verse 18, the child is sick, and then this child dies. Okay, that is exactly what promised, what was told, foretold by Nathan, the prophet of God. The idea was David seems to be in mourning and pleading with God of saying, Lord, maybe you'll change your mind. Maybe if I beseech you that you'll change this end result, God doesn't. And the consequence that he said was coming. And then David makes kind of this odd progression, right? So he won't eat, he won't get up, he won't eat food. And then in 18 it says, the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, behold, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him and he did not listen to our voice. How can we tell him that his child is dead since he might do harm to himself? They're like, David is such an emotional basket case right now. If we add one more thing to that, man, he may pop. And if he finds out his kid is now dead, he may not recover from this. So, but oddly, in verse 19, this is David's response. Would you read that?
But when David saw that his servants were whispering to him, David received that the child was dead. So David said to his servants, is the child dead? And they said, he is dead.
Keep reading, Jimmy.
So David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And he came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him, and he ate.
So, an odd response, right? So his kid dies. He gets up, takes a shower, walks into the tabernacle or the temple, whatever David's got to worship, worships God, takes a shower, and he's like, okay, what's for dinner? And I'm like, man, what is this thing that you've done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but when the child had died, you arose and ate food. This doesn't seem right to them. And David's response is pretty telling. Let's read that in 22 and 23.
He said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live.
Nice. We talked about that. Maybe God will change his mind. Keep rolling.
But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not.
All right, meaning he's dead. Like, there's nothing else I can do. He's not going to return to me. He's dead. So what's done is done. This is my issue, right? And God has brought the consequences of my own sin on me. And then he says something fascinating, and this is good, we'll chew through this. Can I bring him back again? Meaning, can I bring him back from the dead? Answer being, no, of course not. I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. What is David saying in that statement? I shall go to him. Potentially, that's one interpretation. So it could mean as simply as I'm going to go to him, meaning one day I'm going to die, and we're all going to die. We're all going to end up in the same place. So I'm going to go where he is in death. Okay. Now, if David is writing this with any sort of theological bent, what does he foresee in the future? Is he ever going to see his kid again? David says, yes, I think I'm going to go to him. What do you do when you encounter, and this is, gang, you will, I promise you, at some point in your life you're going to be here. You're going to sit across from somebody who has lost a child in death, and they're going to say to you, Jane, Emily, Hannah, is my kid in heaven? How do I handle this? They weren't old enough to understand the gospel. Maybe they were young and innocent and just hadn't been there yet. This kid obviously is days old. There's no way to communicate, you know, in our lens, you know, 2,000 years later with Jesus, there is no way for a kid to understand and assimilate the gospel, to receive grace by faith. Like, that's not possible. What does God do with one like that? Now, biblically speaking, as we look at total depravity, what do you do with that situation? Where does that kid, according to our theology, where they end up?
Depends on what your view.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a hardcore, like, we're all born into sin and brought forth in iniquity, theologically, you'd say, man, everybody outside of the gospel goes to hell. So what do you do in that situation? Is that consistent with the nature of God? There's a lot of folks that go to this text to support the idea of maybe an age of accountability, or a sense that maybe that's not how God handles folks that aren't able to do that. So maybe that's somebody with a mental disability, even though they're 30, still cannot assimilate the gospel themselves and process it. Maybe there's grace in that. But man, I remember sitting again with Jared Rumley. We went to a movie as a staff on a Friday afternoon. This was years ago. Walk out of the movie, I'm heading home, and I get a call from our kids director at the FIG campus that day and said, Jared's kid just died. I'm like, Jared who? Like, Jared Rumley. I was with Jared Rumley 30 minutes ago. What are you talking about? Kid went down for a nap and never woke up. No idea what happened. No fault of anybody, just kid had SIDS and never woke up from a nap. And this kid was I think Tyler was like 6 months old at the time. And man, just like, what do you do in that moment? And what do you tell Jared in the shrapnel of his life when he's trying to figure out what is God doing? Why did this happen? He's rightly angry and frustrated and sad and experiencing this gamut of emotions. Gang, you will sit in that seat one day. What do you say when that happens? I said nothing for a long time, and I just went and sat with him. I walked into his living room, and there were probably 25 people sitting on the floor, just present. One of the greatest things is, just as a side note, one of the greatest things you can do in people's grief is just be present, just be there. Love them, say, I'm sorry, I hurt with you, I'm here, and shut up. So there wasn't much to say. Jared's got his theological bearings together, right? So, people are looking for hope in that moment, right? People are looking for, is God still good in those times? And I think this is a passage that we can turn to. I wouldn't say definitively that's what David's saying here, that this kid's going to be in heaven, but I think there's certainly room here to say David sees some type of reuniting with his kid one day. That may just be in death. That may be all he means here, or he literally may mean no. He is still very much alive, spiritually speaking, and I'm going to join him one day, and we will be in what is, in our context, heaven together. So so when folks are looking for that, that's usually where I'll take him.
What is the part where he says, but he will not return to me?
He can't come from death to life, but I can go from life to death. Katie?
In the Old Testament, did people think that they could lose their salvation? Like, there's no way that he'd be saying, like, I'm have sinned and therefore I'm going to hell. I don't see that. So
yeah.
Just on a bigger picture, how did they see?
That's a good question. They would have looked at that differently than you and I do. I don't think those lenses are present here. They would have leaned into the promises and the character of God. You know, you see as early as Abraham the idea that there is something after death. So that idea of this is not just it. We just don't die and go away. It's just fatalism. What's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, there's the idea that there's more to life. So they certainly had an idea of an afterlife. But it was based on the promises and character of God. What's that?
Annihilation.
Yeah, annihilationism. Thank you. Yes, it's just not here today, gone tomorrow. So, but yeah, they would have looked at it as a, man, we trust in the Lord. We're walking in His promises. We believe those. So that would have been the key to this. And they don't distinguish. They talk about Sheol in the Old Testament. Heaven, as we think about it today, doesn't exist even for us yet. It's still yet to be created in the fullest sense. They would have believed in the Old Testament that there was like a holding tank for the righteous dead, a pause button, if you will, before ultimate judgment and their final being brought into the presence of the Lord forever and forever and forever. That's why Jesus preaches victory to the saints after his death on the cross, tells, you know, so that sort of thing. So their theology would have been different. That's why we need to be careful not to read too much into this, but I see room for it. No, there's certainly the understanding of there's a difference between the righteous dead and the wicked dead, for sure. Now, the full details of what that is don't get revealed until later. So in the Old Testament sense, there definitely is not a clear clear understanding of that. That gets clear with us in the Bible and all that. So that's still coming. So, but gang, you'll be here. You will sit in that living room one day. Someone close to you will walk that road.
This troubled me too, this topic, because somebody was asking me about all the abortions that take place,
mm-hmm.
and if, you know, we're brought forth uniquely, then every abortion, all of those kids are instantly being granted a ticket to hell. And so I was reading through, and I found a passage in, I believe it was Matthew, and also in Mark, where Jesus is talking about having the faith of a child, in that the faith of the child is what allows us to go to heaven. And so when we as adults revert back to the faith of a child, we then are allowed into the kingdom. And so he's saying that, or at least it was the commentary that I was reading, he's saying that children have that faith in their initial father, just like he says, you know, we see the signature of creation,
mm-hmm.
it's evident. And the same thing with kids, like they understand until they become conscious. And then once they become conscious and they understand that, and then there's a difference. And so it was interesting, the commentary of how he
used that's, yeah, saying. That's an interesting one. Yeah. So where you guys go to paint that picture is, you know, it's hard. There's not clear text on what do you do with the salvation of a child or lack thereof. And those are horribly honest questions you have to ask. Like, what do you do with aborted babies? Like, that's not their fault, right? So I lean to the side that we have a gracious father, and that seems inconsistent with his character that he would send a kid that cannot, by any sense, put their faith in Christ, that God would punish them for that. So, but I don't have a verse in text to take you to either. So. Yeah, and that's kind of the idea. And even as I was talking about later, what if there is no age of accountability because you're mentally handicapped? What if you cannot, if you have Down syndrome or some type of mental disability that you cannot mentally get there? I don't know. So those are hard questions. So anyway, what's that? Exactly, right? Those will be questions that we get answered one day, but that's his business. So we lean on his character in those moments and be with people. So, okay, you'll be there. All right?
If anyone drives a Volvo, their lights were
red. Yep, they are. 24th, thank you. So 24 now, David comforted his wife Bathsheba. He went into her and lay with her. She gave a birth to a son, named him Solomon. Now the Lord loved him, sent word through Nathan the prophet, named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. By the way, does that sound like a relationship that was started in rape?
No.
No, it doesn't to me. Okay, so again, I don't see it with David and Bathsheba. It's possible, but I don't see it. Okay. Joab fought against Rahab. So I'm sorry, before we move on. So we got Solomon. His name from the Lord is Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord. So this is almost God's gracious provision in the sense that, yes, I took your son. David, I'm not done with you. I'm giving you another one. Obviously, we know here Solomon's the next king. We know what's coming, but this is the guy that's going to sit on the throne. And he's way down the line in terms of number of sons. I forget where he fits in. But David's got a number of male kids that would have been on the throne, speaking of. We're going to see them here in a second. But Solomon is the guy that the Lord's going to pick. Okay? So now, again, love and hate Joab. Here's where you're going to love him. This guy's absolutely brilliant. Okay, Joab is fighting against Rob, against the sons of Amnon. David's at home mourning. He sends a message to David, says, "Man, I fought against Rabbah. I've even captured the city of waters. Now, therefore, gather the rest of the people together, camp against the city, capture it, or I will capture the city, and it will be named after me." So literally, he is giving this city to David on a silver platter. "I've done my job, David. You're at home mourning. Get off your duff. Come out here. Finish the battle and get the glory as a king of winning this battle." What is Joab doing? What is he trying to do with David here? Yeah, he's trying to exalt him. He's trying to elevate him. He's trying to get him out of his funk a little bit, right? Which David needs to mourn. That is good, right? And people need time to mourn over a heartbreak. But he's trying to get him to, he's got to lead the people. Like, David, regardless of how you feel, you've got millions of people who are sheep, and they need a shepherd. And that's your job, buddy. So, like it or not, you need to step up. So, watch what David does in 30.
"So then he took the crown of their king from his head, and its weight was a talent of gold. And in it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head. And he brought out the spoil of the city in great amounts."
Keep going.
"He also brought out the people who were in it, and set them under saws, sharp iron instruments, and iron axes, made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus he did to all the cities of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem."
So the idea is he executes justice of some sort to the people that were in the city. David wins the day, he is honored, and the people follow him. They return to Jerusalem. So the idea is, Joab is trying to get David back in front of his people leading again. So Joab's an interesting dude, and you're going to hate him here in a couple more chapters, but he speaks into David's life, right? Truth. And sometimes he's a loose cannon, but sometimes he offers great advice. And this was something that David needed to do. He needed to lead in this moment, and does, and reunites a broken people that are mourning with David. Okay. So now chapter 13. This is an awful chapter. We've seen signs of it coming. We've seen the story before in other characters. But here is, again, the ramifications of a jacked up home. Too many wives, too many concubines, too many sons and daughters. This is what you get, and this is at least what David gets. 13:1.
"Now it was after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And Amon, the son of David, loved her."
All right, so we've got Absalom, who's the third oldest son, okay, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, full-blood brother and sister, okay? But you've got Amnon, one of the sons of David, the firstborn son of David, loves her, okay? This is her half-brother, same dad, different moms, okay? Absalom and Tamar, full-blood brother and sister, Amnon, half-brother, loves his sister Tamar. So we know, according to the law, this is a no-no, right? But he says he loves her, and I'll take that word loosely, okay? Amnon was so frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he made himself ill, for she was a virgin, and it seemed hard for Amnon to do anything to her. He is sexually frustrated that he can't have her, okay? That is his desire. Now, he's got a buddy named Jonadab who's not real high on my list. He's down there with Doag, the son of Shema. David's brother, and Jonathan was very shrewd, and he says to him in verse 4, "O son of the king, why are you pressed in mourning after her? tell me. And Amnon said, I love her. And he says, okay, well, let's devise a plan. Let's do this. Jonathan says, or Jonadab says in verse 5, lie down in your bed, pretend to be sick. When your father comes to you, say to him, hey, please let Tamar, my sister, come and give me food to eat. Let her attend to me while I have the flu or whatever, right? And then he says, now, when your sister comes in, she's going to make you a couple cakes in verse 6, that David is now granted that to be the case. Let her take care of you. And what we're trying to do is find an opportunity for you to be alone with her. And then you will do what your desires are to do, whether by coercion, by consent, but you're going to get what you want. It's basically the advice that he's been given by his buddy John and Dab. Okay? Verse 8, Tamar went down to her brother Amnon's house, who's lying down. She took dough, kneaded it, cakes. David has authorized this. She's taking care of her sick half-brother, so she thinks. Verse 9, she took a pan out, dished it before them to eat. And Amnon said, have everyone go out from me. So everyone went out from him. Now it's her and him alone in his bedroom. He says in verse 10, bring the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand. Like literally feed me like grapes. And he says in verse 11 what his desire was the whole time. Come, lie with me, my sister. I want to sleep with you. Okay, he says very clearly what his desires are. Verse 12, look at her answer.
But she answered him, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel.
All right, what is her answer? No. Okay, this is very clearly a case of rape. She says no. She goes beyond just the answer and says, such a thing is not to be done. It's disgraceful in Israel, right? According to the law, this is not to be done. I'll be disgraced. You'll be disgraced, right? So she even gives a why as to why this is not her desire. So again, very, very clear picture of unwanted sexual advancements here from her half-brother. As for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? Meaning, I'm a virgin. I've waited. I'm going to be viewed as a raped woman, which in our society is not admirable. It's going to be hard for me to wet. Like, I can't get away from this. And she tries to find a way out, right? And I don't think she means this, but she's trying to do anything to get out of the situation, which I think is wise. She says, now therefore, at the end of verse 13, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. Go talk to David. See what he says, right? Let's go have a conversation. So, and I think, again, the idea, ladies, is whatever and anything you can do to get out of that situation, she is trying to do. However, verse 14, he would not listen to her. Since he was stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. Okay, very clear.
This is yours says it nicer. Mine just says he raped her.
Well, and that's exactly what happened. Okay. Now, verse 15, this is odd. He hated her with a very great hatred, for the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love which he had loved her. And Amnon said, get up, go away. So he doesn't love her. He lusts after her. He gets what he wants and then realizes, I don't love her. I just wanted my sexual desires gratified. And then says, ultimately, you're a piece of meat. Get up and leave, right? So that's how he treats her. But she said, no, because it's the wrong you were sending me away is greater than the wrong that you've done to me. Doesn't take responsibility for it. He's going to cover it up. He says, now throw this woman out of my presence. Lock the door in verse 17. I mean, this guy's a turd. So Amnon has done his sister, his half-sister, wrong on so many different levels. So this is a clear case of rape. We find it out. She goes into mourning in verse 19, ashes in her head, and so on and so forth. Now, verse 20, word gets out. Okay, watch what happens here. So Absalom is keen enough to realize something's happened, and he asks her straight up, has your brother been with you? Like, he knows the desires of Amnon, he's seen it, he's watched it, and he realizes based on her outward actions that this has clearly happened. And what is his advice to her?
Don't take it to heart.
What does that mean? What is she saying? What is he saying to her? He's trying to say, pause, justice will come. I'm going to handle this, okay? I've got this in a way, and we're going to see why he feels responsible. Again, full blood brother and sister, There's a difference, obviously, in this relationship with the two of them, and Amnon is a half-brother. And here's why I think, let's just watch the story unfold. But he's not just saying, get over it. He's not being insensitive. He's not saying, it's not that big a deal, move on. That's not what's going on here. But he's hoping that justice will come for Amnon, okay? Now, watch in 21 what happens. Huh. So what happens? David finds out about it. Dad finds out. Hey, by the way, your eldest son just raped your daughter. What's his response? He's angry. Is that the right response?
Yes.
Yes, he should be angry. He should be furious. Okay? Now, that anger handled biblically should lead to what? Where should this story go from here? There should be consequences. There should be discipline. Now, if you're David, what's the problem with the situation? According to the law, what is the consequence for Amnon at this point?
Death.
Death. He dies. Now, as David, how do you feel about that? Are you angry at the situation? Absolutely. Do you want to kill your son? Probably not, right? This is a rough spot. So David's in a jam, okay? He's in a significant jam. He's very angry. So at least his wits are about him. He's responded correctly, at least in his head. But let's keep reading. 22. Somebody pick up there.
But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister.
What's Absalom waiting on? David. He's heard about it. David's probably processing this. He's waiting to bring justice, but justice is coming. So Absalom is waiting patiently for Dad to act. Now it came after 2 full years. Nothing's happened. David won't act. Absalom says, you know what? Screw it. David won't do something. I've got to take responsibility for my sister. I'm going to have to play the role of Dad here because Dad is silent. He's passive. He's not stepping up. He says, all right, I'm going to devise a plan. And here's his plan. He comes to Dad and says, hey, I hear Amnon is shearing his sheep in some distant town. Dad, why don't you send me to go check on him? David is wise enough to realize, why are you asking to do this? So he knows that Absalom's up to something, but can't quite, Amnon rather is up to something. Sorry, Absalom is up to something. Wanted to kill Amnon. Sure, he thinks I'm talking to her again. And something's going on. And Absalom said, if it's not, please let my brother go with us. He's urging that he can go with him. Absalom urged him in verse 27, and he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So this is very clearly his plan. He says in verse 28, see now, when Amnon's heart is merry within them with wine, when I say to you, strike Amnon, then put him to death. Do not fear, for I have myself commanded you, be courageous and valiant. Meaning, Dad's not going to act. We're going to fake a party. We're going to get Amnon a little tipsy, and then we're going to take advantage of that situation, and we're going to do what Dad should have done 2 years ago, which was execute a rapist in Israel. So that's his heart. Servants did just as they commanded. They basically murder Amnon. It was while they were away in verse 30 that the report came back to David that Absalom has struck down all of the king's sons, and none of them is left. So
he went beyond
what he was supposed to do. At least that's the word on the street, okay? And the initial report that David gets back is Absalom just murdered all of your sons, David. It's not the case. He gets a bad report. He finds out now in verse 33, only Amnon is dead. So David's like, okay, it's not all my kids. It's only Amnon. And it's told to him in the verse 32 before that, because of this deal with Tamar, that's why it's done. He gets reports, and I want you to see in verse 39, the heart of David. Okay, and I'll show you the rest of the story with Absalom in a second. When David hears of this and finally gets the right story, Absalom has murdered Amnon. This is what he says in verse 39, last verse of chapter 13. Okay, so he wants to reunite with his son Absalom, and it says that his heart was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. What does that mean?
He knew that justice had taken place.
David realizes that's what should have occurred. I've had 2 years to do that, and I didn't have the courage to enact very extreme discipline on my son for what he did. So David is saying, by the law, that was the right thing to do. Okay. Absalom, verse 37, flees and goes to Tamali, Talmi, however you say that, verse 37. Probably not Tamali. Not that. You can tell I took a lot of Hebrew, huh? or English, for that matter. David mourned for his son every day. So they're separated, okay? Absalom has just murdered his brother and is fleeing because he realizes, man, I had to take justice in my own hands. This wasn't done maybe according to the law, according to the edict of the king. So now what's Absalom fearful of? Dude, David may enact justice on me. Like, he realizes their relationship is jacked. And he realizes, man, David, I had to be dad here because you wouldn't be father to my sister. I had to be father to my sister. I had to do ultimately what the law required. Now, Absalom wants to come back to dad. Dad wants to bring Absalom back to reunite, but there's something going on, okay? And this is a really, really important chapter that we need to peel the layers of the onion back as we see this story unfold, okay? So it's a really odd situation. Now, at the end of the day, what should have happened happened. Amnon is dead. It didn't happen the way that God wanted it to happen, I don't think. But nonetheless, he is, according to the law, paid for the consequences of his sin, and Tamar can at least maybe rest in some way that her rapist is now dead and has paid for the sin. Now, 14, you're going to see now another picture of Joab that, again, is absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. 14:1.
Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined towards Absalom.
What does that mean? King's heart was inclined towards Absalom. He wants him back. He wants to bring him back into the kingdom. What's preventing David from bringing Absalom back? He knows where he is.
Was it that massive crowd of people chasing him alongside the mountain?
Nope. We're not there yet. It's passivity. Why would he be ashamed?
Because he knows that he should have done what Absalom did.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's the outer layer of the onion, right? I should have done what Absalom has done, right? Why won't he bring him back and say, son, I love you. I forgive you. I blew it. I put you in a difficult spot. I forgive you for murdering your brother. You did what was right. I wasn't man enough to do it. What's preventing him from doing that? Like, so he's ashamed. I don't think it's pride. Okay, let's keep working through this. This is brilliant. Joab understands. He's already peeled back the whole onion and realizes with David what's really going on. Okay, so verse 2.
But Joab sent to Tekoa and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on a mourning garment. Put on mourning garments now and do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days." Then go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Joab put the words in her mouth.
Okay. So Joab says to this woman, this wise woman from Tekoa, you're going to fake like you're in mourning. And you're going to go to David in mourning, and I'm going to tell you exactly what to say. You're going to be Nathan the prophet. You're going to play a role, and you're going to tell a story. It's a fake story. It's fiction, but it serves a purpose. Okay? Because Joab sees something going on in David that's off, and he's trying to get to the layer of that onion. Okay, now, here's the story. She goes in verse 4. Alex, keep reading.
Now, when the woman of Tekoa said to the king, she fell on her face into the ground and prostrated herself and said, "Help, O king." The king said to her, "What is your trouble?" And she answered, "Truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead."
Okay, so she's a widow. Husband's dead. Keep rolling.
"Your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them. No, so one struck the other and killed him."
Oh, so what's happened? I have two boys. They got in an argument. It was, you know, unprovoked. It just, they got in an argument. No one was there to break up this fight. And one son kills the other son. Sound familiar, David? Keep going.
Now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that they may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also.
So now what's the problem that this woman is dealt with, or left with? She has one surviving son, and what is the rest of the family saying? He murdered the other son. He deserves death. Murder is not okay. So she's stuck, right? I already got one dead son. I don't have a husband. If I lose him, I lose the whole kingdom, all my land, everything, is my, it's going to get passed along, right? So what do I do? Same situation, right? David has two sons, Amnon and Absalom. Amnon commits a grievous sin, deserves death. David won't execute justice. Absalom then murders Amnon. So Absalom is in hiding. Why? Because David could have to, you know, exactly, right? Hey, this wasn't right. You did wrong. So now I'm going to have two dead sons. So she has painted the picture, but it's actually deeper than that. That's not the last layer of the onion, okay? So David's answer is, do we finish 7?
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
And the king said to the woman, go to your house and I will give orders concerning you.
What's he say? Let me think about it. How long do you think about it, David? 2 years? What's he saying? Go away. I don't want to make a decision. I'm being passive. I don't have the courage to do what's right here. So what is the right decision here? What should David do at this point?
Well, David should have addressed the Tamar-Absalom issue and executed Absalom. That's what should have done.
Right.
But since Amnon did it for David.
Absalom, yep. I'm with you.
David should again take ownership and say, thank you for doing my job and recognize what needed to be done, I should have done, and you did in my stead. That's what he should do.
So yeah, so that's the million-dollar question. What's the right response from David now? Is his second son, Absalom, now a murderer as well? Does he deserve justice, or does he deserve grace? Because he's just picking up where David left off, right? So this woman is not going to be content with that, okay? And this is, again, the brilliance of Joab. The woman of Tekoa says, oh, my lord the king, the inquiry is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. Meaning, make a freaking decision, David. Like, this is my issue. I don't have time for you to go home and noodle on this. And she knows the backstory of what's happened these last 2 years from Joab. So the king says, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore. Meaning, okay, I'm going to make a decision, and what I say goes. If anybody has a problem with this, bring him to me. Okay? Verse 11. She said, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy. Otherwise, they will destroy my son. If we keep going back and forth with, now they're going to kill that person, this never ends. There's always going to be a son that gets murdered. So 2, 10, it doesn't matter. Like, there's, if we don't end this, if you don't step in and give grace where grace is required, this process of one killing another for vengeance sake will never end. Okay? David's answer at the end of verse 11, as he said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. So what's David's answer? Grace. Your son deserves grace. It was a mistake. He's not going to die. I don't like it. This shouldn't have taken place. He's not excusing what happens, but he's saying to murder that son does not fix the situation. Okay? Then the woman said, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. Now, Joab's behind this whole thing. He's the puppet master, and he's got his marionettes on the strings. And he's orchestrated this situation just like Nathan did to get David to weigh in on a situation, to speak about what should occur in a situation. David doesn't realize he's back in 2 Samuel chapter 12 all over again, and he's getting played by Nathan in a good way, okay? what has Joab forced David to do regarding the situation that he's in? He's made a decision. Whether he meant to or not, he said, that son is innocent. You should not murder him. And she's going to say as much. Okay, keep reading. Joe, pick up there now in verse 13.
And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? When you speak in the word, the king is as one who is guilty. In that, the king does not bring back his banished one.
So she now flips the whole narrative and says, this has nothing to do with my two kids. This has to do with your two kids. Why have you not brought back Absalom for speaking this word? The king is the one who is guilty, and that he, the king, does not bring back his banished one. You are living a lie. You say one thing, and this is, you judge correctly, David. You assess the situation, and this is what you believe. But when you take that same situation, you will not execute justice the same way. You won't forgive your son. Now, here's the real layer of the onion. Why is David having such a hard time forgiving a murderer? Because he's a murderer. David won't forgive Absalom because David hasn't forgiven himself. He's walking in shame, in guilt, because of his own sin. And David can't see the situation clearly because he's still, I think, in a lot of ways, jacked up with this whole issue with Bathsheba and Uriah. We don't know how far after the situation that is. By the way, the timeline gets weird, and these stories that occur all the way through, like, chapter 20, it advances quickly, but we don't have, like, markers to tell us how far things are. We've obviously got kids that are born and kids that have died, but we don't know exactly how far this is. It's at least 2 years, according to verse 23, between what's happened with the initial rape and now David's unwillingness to go, so that it's probably somewhere in that timeline. But David, I think, is still hung up on his sin with Uriah and with Bathsheba, and because he does not feel like he has the moral authority to weigh in on this because he's guilty of the same thing, I think he's not understanding the forgiveness that he has from God at this point. There's been consequences, but he's not walking in that forgiveness, so he can't extend that forgiveness horizontally. Does that make sense? This vertical relationship's jacked up, so it's jacking up his horizontal relationships. Does that make sense? And I think ultimately, Joab has seen that. He recognizes David is not David right now. He's walking in shame and guilt and not living in forgiveness and confessing it and fully embracing the forgiveness that's been offered. And as a result, he can't lead. He can't shepherd his people. And Absalom is suffering the most in the midst of this because he needs the same grace that's been extended to David, but David won't extend it to him. Okay? It's a great nugget. There's a lot of layers to this onion, but I think at the core of it, it's not about pride. It's about shame. I think David is walking in unforgiveness right now, though he's been forgiven. And Nathan said immediately, right, when that happened, I've sinned against the Lord, and Nathan says, you're forgiven. However, there are going to be consequences, but there's forgiveness there that's offered immediately, okay? It's just a great nugget on, man, what can be underneath the surface, and Joab is able to fish that out of David, put him in a situation where he has to own that and walk in that forgiveness. But I think ultimately what's behind the scenes with this issue is David's issue with his own sin, okay? So, for what it's worth. So, the lady goes on. She's brilliant. David says now in, she goes on to communicate like all that is there. Verse 17, please let the word of my Lord the king be comforting, for as the angel of the Lord, so is my Lord and the king to discern good and evil, and may the Lord your God be with you. So she's saying, man, I hope this is helpful for you in a sense. And watch what David says now to her in verse 18. So what's David recognize? Joab figured this out, right? And though he's a loose cannon, man, in a chapter from now he's going to be a loose cannon again, he realizes that. And she says, it was he, end of verse 19, who put all the words into my mouth of your maidservant. So yes, he's communicated all that. And the king says now to Joab in verse 21, behold now, I will surely do this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom. So he goes to Joab and says, you won. I get it. And I want Absalom now to come back. Bring him back. Joab arose, went to Geshur, and brought Absalom back to Jerusalem. Again, he knows exactly where he is. Now, here's the issue. 24. Keep reading.
And the king said, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence.
Why? Why?
David's still ashamed.
He's still ashamed. Has he forgiven himself? No. Has he completely forgiven Absalom? No. He's stuck in this cycle, right? He can't get out of it. You talk about a father wound. You're about to see a kid that's not going to go the straight A route. He's going to go the nutso kid. He's going to get his daddy's attention any way he can. What is Absalom yearning for at this point? He just needs to see David. He needs a hug from his father. I love you. I forgive you. We're okay. Like, he needs 30 seconds with dad. And that is the only thing that can fix the situation. But David can't get there because he's not there.
Well, I think it's interesting, at least from my perspective, this book is obviously from the perspective of David and what David's going through. But it would be interesting to have a book or a narrative written from the perspective of Absalom and what he's dealt with in his upbringing, as well as what he's seen his father not do in the coming of this age. It wasn't that at 2 years plus Absalom was all of a sudden said, oh, my dad will take care of it eventually.
Yep.
It was, my dad's never going to take care of it. It's been 2 years. And so I don't know what his age was at this particular point, but I can only assume that throughout the age, he's seen his dad on many other smaller occasions not take action.
Absolutely. Where did we see this start with David, by the way? This issue of not dealing with sin in his family. You guys remember?
At the one guy who...
when was that? You guys remember when Joab murdered Abner? Hebron, and he says, the sons of Zeruiah are too much for me. I don't want to deal with them.
Yeah.
That's his cousin or his nephew. David does nothing. He can't, he won't step in and execute justice. So we're seeing from the very get-go of David's kingdom, this is a quality in David, and a negative one. And this, to your point, has probably been a series of things where Absalom wakes up one day and realizes, nothing's ever going to change. If I don't execute justice, justice will not be served. So he does. And now, in the midst of this, here is a kid that has a glaring father wound. He just needs dad to step in and say, man, I blew it. This is on me. This is not on you. I love you. You're accepted. Come sit at the table with me. Let's eat dinner. We're good. That's all he needed. David could have fixed this in 30 seconds. But he sends him away. For verse 28, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. He's living next door to David, and David will not speak with him. Again, still stuck in the cycle of shame. Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come. So he sent him a second time, and he would not come. So Absalom's working his ankle, saying, Joab, will you talk to David for me? You're the only guy that, you know, that he listens to. Joab won't respond. Verse 30, tell me if this took some cojones. Read that.
Therefore he said to his servant, see, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servant set his field on fire.
Now, dude, there's a lot of people in David's kingdom you can screw with. Joab's not one of them. He sets his field on fire. He burns his income. It says, if you won't go to dad for me when I ask you to, I'm going to get dad's attention. So he sets the field on fire of Joab. How do you think Joab responded to that? He ain't happy, right? Joab arose, went to Absalom. Why have your servants set my field on fire? And he said, behold, I sent for you, saying, come here, that I may send you to the king. And you said, why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better for me to still be there. Why did David bring me here to not see me? I would rather be banished. This is worse. Let me see the king's face, verse 32. And if there is iniquity in me, then let me be put to death. Meaning, I still don't know how Dad feels about this situation. If I deserve death, then great, give me death. If I deserve grace, then give me grace. But I'm in purgatory right now. Like, I don't know what's going on. So, Joab, verse 33, finally is able to reunite these two. Joab came to the king, and he told him, and he, David, calls for Absalom. Thus he came to the king, prostrated himself, his face to the ground, and the king kissed Absalom. Now the problem is, it's too little, too late. Absalom is furious. He's built a wall. David is trying to tear down that wall now, brick by brick, but he's allowed that wall to be erected between he and Absalom, and Absalom's done. He's just emotionally done. So, as a result, chapter 15, Absalom is going to give David the worst part of it. God promised David what when he sinned with Bathsheba? What was there going to be in your house? Division and the sword. Here comes the sword. Came about after this, Absalom provided for himself a chariot, horses, and 50 men as runners before him. Absalom, verse 2, used to rise early, stand beside the way of the gate, used to stand in the gate. Happened that when any men would come in and have an issue of judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "Hey, what city are you from?" He'd say, "Man, I'm from your whatever city where your tribes of Israel." Absalom would say, "Hey, see, your claims are good and right, but no one listens to you on the part of the king. Man, you've got this issue, but the king's too busy to listen to you. I'm the king's son. Bring it to me. Oh, this is, it's so important what you're saying. I want to listen to you and weigh in on this issue. Oh, that, verse 4, one would appoint me judge in the land, then every man who has a suit or a cause could come to me and I would give him justice." What my dad is not doing. What is he doing? He's becoming the man. He's starting a coup. And he's creating a faction between him and David. All these people, David, that you're called the shepherd, you're not shepherding. I'd shepherd you. Oh, if I was king, I would do all that. He's campaigning, right? He's putting out his business card saying, "This is what I plan to do." It's clear as day, okay? It happened, verse 5, when a man came to prostrate himself before him, he would put his hand out and kiss him and take hold of him. Verse 6, Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. This guy is slick, he's smart, he's brilliant. We're going to find out he's heck of good looking, right? He is he's everything you want, right, in a leader. And the people love him. Now, came about at the end of 40 years. That's a typo, by the way. Should be 4 years. Some of your texts probably say that. Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron." So he says he's planning a coup. Okay. David permits him to go. Verse 30, go in peace. Absalom in verse 10 sent spies throughout all of Israel and said, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say Absalom is king. There's a coup coming. Here's the sign. As soon as you hear me, then this is what we're going to do." Then, in verse 11, 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem who were invited, went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent Ahithophel, the Gileonite, David's counselor, from the city while he was offering sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Ahithophel, by the way, is Bathsheba's grandfather. So when Absalom revolts, Ahithophel was the counselor, one of the counselors of David, who's still bitter about what happened with Bathsheba and Uriah. When Absalom revolts, he changes teams. And he says, "You know what? I'm with Absalom. Just to stick it to David because of his issues with my granddaughter, I'm out." Okay, so Absalom is now leading a revolt. Now, if you're David, what do you do when your son starts a coup? Do you go to guns? Do you fight him? Tough decision. So the hearts of verse 13 of the men of Israel are with Absalom. David said to his servants in verse 14, "Arise, let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom." Let's get up and let's get out of Dodge. This is a bad situation, and if we don't leave, we're all going to die. The idea is David says, "Man, I'm not going to fight my son. I'm not going to fight for this throne," which, to David's credit, I think is a wise move. Okay, David leaves in verse 16, 10 concubines to keep his house. So these are the women that ultimately are going to care for his palace while he's gone. But he leaves. He takes, in verse 18, 600 men that came with him from Gath, the Gittites. They pass before the king. There's a guy by the name, I told you guys about this guy before, Ittai the Gittite, one of my favorite dudes in scripture. So he's from Gath, and he says, why also should we go with us? David says to him, return, remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and an exile. Return to your own place. David says, man, don't be an exile with me again. We've done that before. Stay here. And Ittai says in verse 21, as the Lord lives, as my Lord the king lives, surely wherever my Lord the king may be, wherever for death or for life, there your servant will be also. So he says, man, I'm loyal to you. I'm not loyal to this palace. I'm loyal to you. So I'm going with you. Come hell or high waters, basically what he's saying. And David says, okay. So they leave town. There's a number of people that go with David. There's a number of people that stay. They pass over in verse 23, the Kidron Valley. So they're going east out of the land into the wilderness. So not a great place. Zadok, verse 24, rather, the high priest comes out with the Ark of God with David. And watch what David says now in verse 25 regarding the Ark. So what does he say about the ark?
Take it back.
It's not mine. Leave it here. It belongs here. If God's found favor with me, maybe I'll get to see it again. Now, the ark would have been kind of a lucky rabbit's foot in battle, right? That's not a bad thing to have around you. But he says, man, that's not what this is about. My son wants control. That's fine. I'm not going to fight him. Leave the ark here. And if God is so gracious to give the kingdom to me, he gave it to me in the first place, I'll get it back again. If not, then... okay, sarah, sarah. So that's kind of his attitude. So he leaves. David, in verse 30, goes up the Mount of Olives, which is down the Kidron Valley, up the Mount of Olives, okay, up and over, and he's covering his head. They walk barefoot. Verse 31, someone tells David, Ahithophel is one of the conspirators with Absalom, your buddy, your counselor, Ahithophel. This is Bathsheba's grandfather, is with now, Absalom, he's abandoned you, David. And by the way, we're going to see in the text, Ahithophel's advice is like gold. It's like having King Midas on your staff. Anything he says, you listen to. His advice is perfect every time. So David says to this guy named Hushai in verse 32, who's with David, he says, man, I need you to stay. And your job is to fake like you're on Team Absalom when you're really on Team David. And any advice that Ahithophel offers to Absalom, you've got to counter that advice. And you're going to have to play the card of, I'm loyal to you, Absalom. That's what you need Absalom to think. And you're going to need to make it sound like your advice is better than Ahithophel's. So David puts a mole, basically, in the kingdom. The mole's name is Hushai, the Archite. And he's going to be the one that's going to counter Ahithophel's advice. And you'll see kind of what that looks like here in a minute. Okay, he says at the end of verse 34, David does, you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Meaning, with Ahithophel on Absalom's payroll, I'm as good as dead. He's going to come after me. Ahithophel's going to know what to do. He knows all my inner workings. He knows everything, right? So he knows how to defeat me. So if Absalom is wise enough to listen to this guy, then we're dead in the water. This thing's over and we're going to die because I'm not going to fight my son. Okay, he says, however... I need you to basically stay here. Okay, so this coup has been started. Now in chapter 16, we've seen this story before. This is Ziba and Mephibosheth. Ziba comes out, says, hey, here's some stuff for your journey, David. Mephibosheth's back at home saying, yay, maybe the kingdom's going to come back to me. So we've read chapter 16 or most of it. We'll see a couple more characters before we move on.
Now, in this process, I'm not seeing David come to the Lord and fast with the Lord, pray to the Lord, like this.
Yeah,
this doesn't seem like the behavior of what we have seen in the past with David.
We will. I think he's. You're going to see that eventually, and I kind of grant it to him here just based on what we're going to see as he moves forward. I think he's humble enough to not fight for the throne. I think a lesser guy would have stood up and fought against his son just because that would have been. A point of pride for him to say, I'm the king, and he lets it go. So I think he's walking in humility. I think at this point he's recognized his sin, and he's dealing with that. But yeah, you don't see a lot of that yet. It's coming. So whether or not, I can't speak for sure as to where David's heart is at this point, but it seems like, based on what's coming, that he's getting there, or maybe is there now. So
I would just expect, I guess, from what David has done in the past with decisions, at least big decisions. I mean, you have a coup. This is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Where you have David go to God.
Yeah.
And
what do you want me to do?
You would hear in the scripture something along the lines of, "You have given me the kingdom. The kingdom is mine.
Yeah.
You know, what should I do with this, you know, issue that I've created," kind of thing. And then you would hear the Lord say, "You know, the kingdom is yours. Let it reign for a little while, and then it'll be back to you." Like, but you don't see that in him counseling with the Lord.
I think this is one of those matters where David's like, "What decision do I have? Like, do I even need to pray about this? What are my options? Kill my son and take the kingdom, or leave? I'm leaving." Like, there's not a, it's one of those, like, man, this is not a decision that requires prayer. This is when the nation of Israel's in sin, and Joshua can't figure it out, and he's praying. And God says, "Get up. This isn't a time to pray. This is a time to act." Like, the reason you're in sin is because Ai took stuff from the band that he wasn't supposed to take. And as a leader, you should know that. Like, because of the consequences, you should have understood what the problem was. You don't need to pray about this. Act. So I think David's in one of those situations where this is a lose-lose. So if I fight and I win, I lose. So the only thing I can do is leave and let God handle it. So I think that's his attitude. That's my take based on what I see. So let's keep going and let's see if kind of David's actions coming change your mind. But what you're going to see is a very gracious David in the midst of this. Okay, look at verse 11. David says now, chapter 16, verse 11, David said to all his servants, "Behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone curse, for the Lord has told him, 'Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of cursing this day.'" So David's talking about the Lord. We don't see him stop and pray. This Benjamite we're about to meet here in a second. But that's the idea. So 13, there's this guy named Shammai. This is a funny dude. David went with his men along the way, and Shammai went along the hillside parallel with him, and he went and cursed him and cast stones and threw dust at him. So as David and his men are leaving town, Shammai is walking on the hillside, flipping them the bird and throwing rocks and dust at them as they leave town. Like, good for you. Get out of here. You know, I call him the cursing mooner. So in my head, at least, I see him mooning David from the top of the deal. So this guy's a chump. Like, he's just being a turd. Like as if David doesn't have it bad enough, this guy's rubbing his nose in it, right? Like, ha ha, that type of guy. So he's being a punk. The king and all his people were with him, arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. So they're beat down. But this guy's being an absolute jerk face to him along the way. So David's going to take note of that and write his name down. Okay, so we'll see what happens to this Shammai guy later. But David's getting it in a rough way. So his son's trying to take the throne. These guys that said they were loyal to David, as soon as the first opportunity comes to be loyal to someone else, they're laughing at David. So he's seeing a lot of people's true colors in the midst of this. Okay, 15 now, back to Absalom. Pick up there, 15. 16, 15. All right, so Ahithophel, David's old great advisor, Bathsheba's grandfather, goes with Absalom, and Absalom's like, okay, that makes total sense to me. So he has no question of that. He sees Hushai, and he says in verse 17, "Is your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? I know you, and I know your loyalty to David, Hushai. Why are you here?" Hushai was the guy that got planted as a mole by David. So now he's been found out, right? Or at least Absalom's like, hey, you don't fit here. Why are you here? And he says, no. For whom the Lord, this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, this I will be, and with him I will remain. God's picked you. If you're God's guy, then you're my guy. Besides, whom shall I serve? Shall I not serve in the presence of his sons? I've served with your father's presence, so I will serve in your presence. If you're the new guy in town, yes, I was loyal to your father. God's clearly put you on the throne. Absalom, I'm with you. And Absalom says, okay. That makes sense to me. So he brilliantly convinces Abishai, or Absalom rather, that he's indeed on his team. Okay, now 23, we see the advice of Ahithophel. Last verse that he gave in those days was as if one inquired of the word of God. It's like you were speaking to God Almighty Himself when you asked Ahithophel, hey, what should I do? Should I buy Apple stock right now? Yes. Okay, I'm going to, you know, or whatever. Like this guy was as good as gold when he gave advice, okay? Now, 17:1, here is Ahithophel's advice, okay? He says to Absalom, take 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David now, tonight. Give me 12,000 guys that can fight. I will come upon him, verse 2, he is weary and exhausted. I will terrify him so that the people who are with me will flee. Then I will strike down the king alone. I will bring back the people to you. The return of everyone depends on the man you seek. Then all the people shall be at peace. Meaning, David is exhausted. He's been walking out of town. Shimei's been mooning him on his way out. They don't have food. They're exhausted. We need to strike right now, Absalom. Let me go. Give me 12,000 dudes. I'm going to kill your father and return the people to you. This time tomorrow, you're the king of the land. The coup's over. That is great advice if you're Absalom, okay? And if you're Ahithophel, who is not a fan of David, that is brilliant advice. Then Absalom said, now call Hushai, the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say. So he says, okay, Absalom, or Ahithophel, I hear what you're saying. Hushai, what do you have to say? You were one of my dad's servants. Surely you've got some great advice for me. Now, Hushai is on Team David, and he's going to have to give different advice, and it's going to have to seem better. Okay? Here's what he says. This time, verse 7, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good. This would have been the first time in history that this guy's advice wasn't great. Okay? So watch what he does. Now, verse 8, somebody pick up there. Man, your dad's like a mama bear rod of her cubs. He is angry, he is mad, and he's a fighter. He's brilliant. Absalom, that's not you. In fact, he sent the people along. He's hiding in caves. And when you go to attack the people, boy, he's going to come out and he's going to spank you. And you're not even going to see it coming. He said, you don't want to do this, Absalom. Even the one who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will completely lose heart. You're going to lose this battle. You don't want to do this. I counsel that all of Israel shall surely be gathered to you. Hey, I'm on your team, Absalom. However, you do not go. You should go personally into battle. Verse 11. You need to go yourself. Don't send somebody else. You need to kind of handle this. Verse 12. So we shall come to him in one of the places where he can be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground, as of one. And of him and all his men who are with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, that all Israel shall bring ropes into that city. We will drag it into the valley. We'll break down the city if that's what it takes. But you don't want to do this. So he's trying to buy David time to get out of town and not get attacked because he knows David will lose. So Ahithophel's advice is actually perfect and what Absalom should do. But he chooses not to. And he says the counsel of Hushai in verse 14 is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. So, plan works for David. Verse 15, Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, this is what Ahithophel counseled Absalom and the elders of Israel. This is what I have counseled. Send quickly and tell David, do not spend the night in the fords of the wilderness. By all means, cross over, or else the king and the people who are with him will be destroyed. Hushai sends word to David saying, I won, you listen to me. David, get out of Dodge. He sends people to go tell David what the word is. Like, get out of here, and you're safe. And basically says, man, he's coming, but he's not coming tonight. So you guys can rest in peace, refuel yourselves. This is how much Ahithophel, by the way, thinks of his own advice, verse 23. So it's sad, but he's not used to not being listened to. Dude, went home, signed his will, cleaned the kitchen, washed the dishes, and hung himself. Like, God, dude. So he can't handle the fact that Absalom wouldn't listen to him. Like, his whole job is to be a counselor, and this is the first time ever that this doesn't work. So
he must have won high school debate every year.
Seriously, you don't want to talk with that guy, right? So
his closing argument was, well, if you don't don't pick me, I'm going to go kill myself.
Huh. Oh, okay, then. You know, still listen to Hushai, but if that's how you want it to go down. Yeah, that's it's a strong closing argument. But it, apparently it didn't work. So now, David now came to Mahanaim. That is where Jacob spent some time on the east side of the Jordan. Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he with all his men. Absalom set Amasa over his army in place of Joab. Amasa is David's nephew. Amasa and Joab are cousins. Okay, so David has kids from two different women, and these are two of the sons from those two different women. Amasa and Joab are cousins. Okay, so just remember that, they're family. Amasa is the new general in town. Joab is still loyal to David, at least at this point, and they're now going to fight. Okay, so by the way, we see in verse 29, this guy named Makur, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. Where have we seen Lodabar before, that town? You guys remember that? There was a guy hiding there for a long time. His name was Mephibosheth. This guy, they come to his town, and David is provided for from this guy from Lodabar. I think partly because of his grace that he extended now to Mephibosheth. This guy here takes care of David and his men. Verse 28 sends beds, raisins, pottery, water, food. I mean, feeds his men when they're in the wilderness and they're weary. So David is recharged kind of in this moment as a result of people taking care of him. Okay? Now, we got a couple more minutes left. Let's see if we can cover some of 18 here. So David numbers his people. He's got a couple folks that he can lead out into battle. Verse 2, Joab, Abishai, and our boy Ittai the Gittite. Those are the three like platoons that he's going to send out to go do battle against Absalom. He realizes, man, I'm not going to take the fight to Absalom, but if the fight's coming to me, you know, I can't just let everybody sit here and be dead ducks. So we've got to do something. Look at the end of verse 2. And the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you. What is David saying? I'm going to fight. This is a 50-year-old man at this point. David's in his later 50s, and he's saying, I'm going to go fight because I screwed up in a season of my life where I chose not to, and things went awry. They say in verse 3, man, love you, mean it, you're awesome, but you are worth 10,000 of us. Stay here. So they love David, be like, bro, you're old. So that sort of Goliath, I'm not sure you can pick it up anymore. So stay here. Let us fight. We're young men. Thanks for your heart. Stay here. So he does that. Verse 5, he charges now Joab, Abishai, and he says very clearly, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. So he tells his three generals, deal gently with Absalom. What does that mean? Don't kill him. Okay? Arrest him, put him in handcuffs, do what you need to do. Don't kill him. So, lo and behold, people go out to battle. Verse 7, there was a great slaughter. 20,000 men die. Okay? These are Absalom's men. David wins the battle. Okay? This is funny. Verse 9, Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule. He goes under the branches of an oak tree. His hair gets caught up in the oak tree, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him kept going. He's riding on a mule. His hair catches in the branches. The mule keeps going, and now he's stuck in the air, hung by, like, right? He literally is like a puppet. And look who finds him. Joab rolls up, and he's told, hey, we found Absalom. And he says in verse 11, why then did you not strike him to the ground? And he's like, because the king said not to kill him. And the man said, man, if he should give me a huge ransom, I'm not going to kill Absalom. That would be dumb. The king was very clear saying, don't kill him. Joab says, show me where he is. Verse 14, I will not waste time with you here. Shut your mouth. He took three spears in his hand, thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he's hanging in the tree, yet while he was alive in the midst of the oak. He murders Absalom on the spot with three spears. Done. Joab. What did David clearly tell Joab, Abishai, and Ittai in verse 5? Deal gently with my son. What does Joab do? Man, you want to screw with me? By the way, you don't take Joab's job, okay? You don't rise up against him like this guy. He's nuts. So he has an opportunity to, you know, put him in handcuffs, throw him over the mule, bring him back to David and say, man, here's the chump, here's your son. He murders him on the spot. And Absalom obviously is completely defenseless. He's hanging from a tree by his hair. So he can do nothing. He gets murdered. They took Absalom, cast him into a deep pit in verse 17, erected over him a very great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, each to his tent. So the coup's put down. That's all Joab wanted. We won. How'd you win? It doesn't matter. By any means necessary, he murders now David's son, in a sense that this should have been handled differently according to Joab, or to David at least. Joab doesn't. 21, Joab says to this guy, go tell the king what you've seen. Tell him that he's dead. And he sends now two runners basically to go communicate this message. There's two different guys that are delivering the message. David finds out in verse 29 that one of these runners comes to him at Joab's request, and he says, is it well with the young man Absalom? Okay. He finds out in verse 32 from the second runner, he says, let the enemies of my Lord, in verse 32, the king, and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. Meaning, anybody that tries to stand up to you, David, I hope their end game is just like this guy Absalom's, meaning your son got murdered. And everybody that rises up against you should get murdered. In 33 now, listen to what David says, last verse of chapter 18. And this all is because of David's lack of leadership in the home. Ultimately, he causes his son's death because he wouldn't step up and lead, and he causes this rift between he and his son. Yeah.
There is a choir piece that I have done set to the text, 2 Samuel 18:33.
Really?
It is probably one of the most beautiful pieces I have ever been a part of.
Huh. Yeah, dude, bring it. I'd love to see it.
Honestly,
yeah.
One of the best pieces I've ever sung. And, yeah.
It's cool, man. Yeah. Bring it. Soprano. So, anyway, so this all ends in a bad way. The coup's put down. This was not David's heart. So we'll see kind of the ramifications of that tomorrow and where that leads. But obviously, this is no bueno. So, all right. We'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thank you.